So, tonight we're going to discuss Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, who they were, or the differences between them, what were the similarities between them. Earlier, in an earlier session, we saw a source that implied that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai were the beginning of Machloket. Right? You only had the Machloket about Smicha, saw the Mishnah in Chagiga. You had a Machloket about Smicha, leaning on an animal for several generations. And after those generations, you had this proliferation of disputes between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. So according to that source, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are the beginning of dispute. They didn't apprentice sufficiently, lo shimshu kol tzorkan. I have one, I only printed one, but I can... You should have it on your phone. Is that does that work? If not, I can use it on the phone.
I think you do it from your phone. I feel bad.
Yeah, I can read from my phone. I mean, I already know what it says. So.
Okay.
That they didn't apprentice sufficiently, and so Machloket proliferated. Lo shimshu kol tzorkan, and Naaseh HaTorah kishtei Torot, the Torah became like two Torahs. So in one sense, that's true. Before you have Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, there's no record of any dispute. And I mean real-time disputes. I'm not talking about the disputes, the later attempts to understand that, let's say, the argument between Boaz and Ploni Almoni over or not about marrying Ruth was about whether we darshan Moavi velo Moavit. Right. That, I'm not talking about that type of machloket. Real time, Rabbi X says this, Rabbi Y says that. You don't have that before Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. On the other hand, of course there were disputes before the time of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai and during the time of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. The last few hundred years of Bayit Sheni, the last 250 years of Bayit Sheni or so, were characterized by rampant sectarianism. You had the Prushim and the Tzedukim, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, the Baitusim. The Essenes may or may not be the Baitusim. You had diaspora Judaisms like the Judaism of Alexandria, of Philo. You had early Christianity. And then you had political factions like the Zealots and the Sicarii. All kinds. There's a Gemara that says that there were 24 different sects in Judaism, in the Judaism of the late Second Temple period. So there's plenty of disagreement. There are people killing each other. So when you say that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are the beginning of Machloket, what do you mean? The Gemara even seems to says explicitly in certain cases that if there was something that happened, let's say, that went against common procedure. For example, there's a Gemara that says that somebody was put to death by Sreifa, the biblical punishment of, you know, Ba'esh Tisarefu. So the Mishnah says that you do that in a way that doesn't destroy the body, right? You pour hot lead down the person's throat so that it burns up their insides, but it doesn't actually harm the body because, you know, you want to preserve a certain amount of dignity even in death. So the Gemara tells a story about how early in the Tannaitic era, right, in the time of the Zugot, somebody put somebody, I think Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabai, put somebody to death by actually burning them at the stake. Or a similar story. So somebody put somebody together by burning them at the stake, and the Gemara says, no, that was a Beit Din Shel Tzedukim. That was a Sadducee court. So there were courts and there were disputes and there were variant halachas. In the Mishnah Yadayim, you have Omrim Tzedukim Kovlim Anu Aleichem Prushim. There were fights, there were disputes, there were... Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai isn't the beginning of dispute.
Self-autonomous? Everyone was able to...
They were separate communities, they were sects. Sometimes, you know, the balance of power shifted. Sometimes these guys were in charge, sometimes those guys were in charge. The Chasmonaim, starting with Yochanan, Kohen Gadol, they were more allied with the Tzedukim. And one theory is that the Tzedukim, for a long time, people thought that the Tzedukim were just sort of like these chafifnikim, right? They weren't really serious. They weren't really so frum. They were more just Hellenizing or Romanizing. After the discovery of the Dead Sea sect, after the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran, you read some of these scrolls. These people were azoi frum. These were very religious people. And they were very careful about Tuma and Tara, and they were very deliberate and particular about who they would let into their communities. And in order to be accepted into their communities, you had to follow very strict rules. These guys were hardcore. So one theory is that these were the basically puritanical Tzedukim. Right? They're clearly related to the Tzedukim on some level. They talk about, their texts talk about the Bnei Tzedok, right, which is Tzedokim, Sadducees. So we really don't know how society in general all over the country looked. I use the example of, let's say, in 2,000 years, they're doing an archaeological dig here in Israel, trying to understand what Judaism was like in Israel around the year 2000. And they discover this site that happens to be the Karlbach Moshav. Okay? So in a certain sense, it'll give you an interesting picture. It'll give you real data on what was going on in Israel during the time of, in the year 2000. On the other hand, you're getting a very narrow picture. So there are certain things, like you'll get the Parsha sheets that they put out everywhere, but you'll also get some stuff which is a little bit off the rails. Who knows? So that's what's going on here in Qumran. Qumran, you're getting a picture of a very exclusive sect. And so we don't know, you can't look at the text and say, oh, this is a text that everybody had. And you also can't say, oh, this is a text that only these guys had. Which what makes it interesting. Like it's there's been a lot of discovery. It's only in the last generation, since the 1970s, which is almost 50 years now, I guess it's more than a generation, that there's been a lot of attention paid to Tzeduki or sectarian halacha. Right. The first generation of people that studied the Dead Sea Scrolls were Christians, so they were looking for ideology, and they were looking, in a lot of ways, they were looking for what was the ideological matrix in which Christianity emerged. It was only in the early 1970s, one of the pioneers is actually the rabbi of the shul where I grew up, one of the pioneers in looking at Tzeduki, sectarian halacha, is a fellow by the name of Rabbi Professor Joseph Baumgarten. He was a Rav, he was originally from Vienna, I believe he was a Musmuch of the Hildesheimer Seminary. You remember him?
I had the Hebrew College.
Correct, and he taught at the Hebrew College, and he was the rabbi of Bnei Jacob, and he was a bona fide, world-class Dead Sea Scroll scholar, and he was the first one, because his background is halacha, his background is he's an Orthodox rabbi. He looks at this and he's like, oh, that's interesting. That reminds me of a machloket in Yadayim or Machshirin or mostly Taro stuff. Or he looks at it and he says, where it says that the Tzedukim, where these sectarians are saying, oh, we're against those who say A, B, or C. Well, who is it that says A, B, and C? It's the Pharisees, right, who are the bad guys for the Dead Sea Scroll, but the Pharisees are also the proto-rabbis, and this is the halacha that makes it into the Mishnah. So that relationship, right, that's something that's developing throughout these centuries. So when we say that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are the beginning of machloket, what do we mean? There's obviously machloket before that. There's entirely different sects before that. What's unique about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, one other aspect of Beit Shammai, before we go further, is that Beit Shammai was eventually relegated to dead letter status. Beit Hillel won. So if you look at the first sources, so this is a later text, meaning it's from the Gemara. The Gemara is edited 6th century. So you have Amar Rabbi Abba Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Abba says in the name of Shmuel. Shmuel was in the late 3rd century, still a good 300 years after the events ostensibly took place. Shalosh Shanim Nechlku Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. For 3 years, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel fought with each other. Halalu Omrim Halacha Kmotenu. These guys saying the halacha is like us. Halalu Omrim Halacha Kmotenu. The other guy saying, no, it's like us. How was this machloket eventually resolved? Yatza bat kol. A heavenly voice came out and said, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and those are the words of the living God. Meaning both Hillel and Shammai, both Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are the words of God. Divrei Elokim chayim. But halacha, the halacha ki Beit Hillel. The law, halacha, is in accordance with Beit Hillel. You have the source sheet on your phone. The WhatsApp.
Since when do you listen to a bat call?
Right. So first of all, we've already seen that we shouldn't listen to a bat call. Right? So if you... I don't know if you know Aryeh Klapper, Rabbi Aryeh Klapper. He has a Beit Midrash in Boston. He wrote a very provocative article probably about 30 years ago. Interesting article where he applied Gödel's incompleteness theorem to halacha. And he says that Gödel's incompleteness theorem is anytime you have a sufficiently complex system, there will be questions that it won't be able to handle. So you have a machloka between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Okay, Beit Hillel outnumbers Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai, you know, is smaller than Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel says it doesn't matter who's smarter, you go by the majority. Beit Shammai says no, you go by the people who are smarter, who are sharper. So each one is convinced that they're right, and there's no way to decide it. There's a perfect stalemate. The system can't handle it. So you need something ex machina, you need something from outside the system to come in and decide. Okay? The truth of the matter is, I'm not worried so much. I would think that after 3 years, like for the first 3 years, each side's trying to convince the other side. I think at a certain point, you called it a stalemate. And then there was a bat kol that says, halacha kibbeit Hillel. And again, I don't know if this is historic. I don't think this is historical. Again, the first record we have of it is hundreds of years after it ostensibly took place. What I think it means that halacha kmotenu, next week we'll get more into the Baskol thing when we get into the Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. We'll discuss them next week. But...
I mean, is there not precedent
for
this for
majority rules? No. There's not. Hang on a second.
When were Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai?
I'm going to get to that very soon. So now the Gemara asks, hang on, if both of them are, in a sense, ontologically true, why do we paskin like Beit Hillel? And the answer that the Gemara says, because they were more pleasant and they were more patient. And they would teach their own teachings, and they would also teach the teachings of Beit Shammai. V'lo'ot elishamakdimin divrei Beit Shammai lidivreihen. They would put the words of Shammai, of the house of Shammai, before their own words. Ko'otash shaninu, like the case we learned, and now it quotes a Mishnah. Mishnah is an early source. Okay? Mi shehaya rosho v'rubo basuka. Somebody's head and body were in a sukkah, v'shulchano b'toch habayit, and his table was in the house. Beit Shammai poslin. Beit Shammai says it's pasul, meaning he doesn't fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah like that. Beit Hillel machshirin. Beit Hillel says he does. Amru Beit Hillel Beit Shammai. Beit Hillel says to Beit Shammai, Lo kachay amaisa, didn't this happen? Wasn't there a case? Shalchu ziknei Beit Shammai v'ziknei Beit Hillel, that the elders of Beit Shammai and the elders of Beit Hillel went to visit Rabbi Yochanan ben HaChoranit. They went to visit Rabbi Yochanan ben HaChoranit. U'matzu Yoshev Rosho v'ruba v'sukah v'shulchano b'toch habayit. And they saw him dining in exactly this fashion. Amru lehen Beit Shammai. Right, and you didn't say anything to him. Amru lehen Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai says, imisham raya. Afein amrulo. You're going to bring a proof from that. They even said to him, the elders of Beit Shammai said to him, im kachayit enoheg, look, kiyamta mitzvat sukkah miyamecha. You never fulfilled the mitzvah of sukkah.
Apparently he didn't change his custom. Now we don't know, but he probably continued his custom with Beit Hillel.
Right. So in terms of the question of why Beit Hillel won, it's a good question. I think Beit Hillel won. We're going to get into the theories. There are a bunch of theories. We'll get into that within the next few minutes.
There's also, I think we talk about sometimes.
Majority rule we'll get to next week, I promise.
Sometimes we're talking about what's accepted by the people is what is Kodea Halacha, certainly with maybe Hagim or even with Halacha. They weren't willing to accept it that was, Purim, Yantif on Purim, that kind of stuff. So apparently Hillel was able to convince people based on how they presented the material to follow their way, even if maybe Beit Shammai was a better chap or something.
Yeah. It could be.
I think that's
a way to understand Nochin Va'aluvin. I think that you can say that the fact that Beit Hillel quoted Beit Shammai meant that his curriculum became the dominant curriculum. Because it was considered more complete, or it was considered... I think the Gemara is saying something that's very important there, that the halacha that's accepted is not the halacha necessarily that's truer. Right, meaning it's not a... That halacha is creative. That halacha is... The fact that Beit Hillel says that this is the halacha makes it Divrei Elokim Chai. Right? They're both Divrei Elokim Chai. We have to... But I'm saying it's not Divrei Elokim Chaim in some sort of
objective
sense. The fact that Beit Hillel, studying Torah, comes to this conclusion makes it Divrei Elokim Chaim. It didn't have to be predetermined, a predetermined Divrei Elokim Chaim. Okay?
Wait, no. We say Eilu Beilu Divrei Elokim Chaim. Beit Shammai is also Divrei Elokim.
Correct. But that you need to have book, meaning it has to have a certain...
What's not Divrei?
Everybody that's not mentioned in the Mishnah is not Divrei Elokim Chaim. The Sadducees are not Divrei Elokim Chaim. The Essenes are not Divrei Elokim Chaim. The Dead Sea people aren't Divrei Elokim Chaim. Philo is not Divrei Elokim Chaim. Josephus isn't Divrei Elokim Chaim. The Christians aren't Divrei Elokim Chaim. It's just Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai.
And what do they have in common? That's
what we're trying to answer. Okay. The next text that demonstrates, and this is from the Mishnah itself, that demonstrates this, how that Beit Hillel prevailed, right, is also a very well-known Mishnah in Brachot, Beit Shammai Omrim Ba'erev Kol Adam Yatu V'yikra'u V'avoker Ya'amdu. At night, you lay down to say Shema. In the morning, you stand to say Shema. How do we know this? Where does he derive this from? Uv'shachmecha uv'kumecha. When you lay down and when you rise up. So you lay down and say Shema. And you rise up and you say Shema. Beit Hillel Omrin says, no. Lo kol adam kore kedarka. You read however you are. Shene emar uv'lech chavadarach. It says, as you go on your way. You do it as you go on your way. So im kein. So lamanech ne'emar uv'shachmecha uv'kumecha. If that's the case, why does it say uveshachvcha uvkumecha? Why does it say when you lay down and when you get up? So Beit Hillel answers, b'shasha b'nei adam shochvim. You have to say Kriya Shema at the time that people lie down and at the time that people get up. So zmani Kriya Shema seems to be Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai would be like, whenever you go to sleep, you say it. Whenever you get up, you say it. Beit Shammai, sleep till noon. It's all good. I kind of like Beit Shammai on this. Where would you learn it from? You don't see that with Beit Shammai. I kind of like this Beit Shammai.
And Beit Hillel twice a day.
And which is maybe if you go to every time you go to sleep and every time you get up. Yes. Okay. In terms of the pasuk, I like that minhag. In terms of the pasuk, yeah, you can say the chassidim hold like Beit Shammai. In terms of pasuk pshat, which one is closer? Hews closer to the text. Beit Shammai is more textual. Yeah. Beit Hillel's reading is more creative. It's more regimented.
Although I would say both of them, if they're looking for what position you should be in when you say it, it seems like an odd search. I would say there's no position for Krishna. I guess that's what Beit Hillel says a lot, but there.
Yeah. Right, there is no position.
And if we're talking about all the things you do in your life, the different modes of things you do, you should be learning Torah.
We're saying Shema, yeah.
Forget Shema. There's no issue of what body position you're in, I would think.
Well, that's what Hillel is saying. There is no issue of body position. There is no issue of body position. Shakul of Gumecha is just when. It's not how.
Oh, so he said there isn't, meaning...
Look at what there, however you're going, whatever position you happen to be in.
Oh, I see.
Okay? So now, it tells a story. So first it presents the machloket, and Beit Shammai comes before.
Beit Shammai apparently thinks it is important to position your
body. Yes. And Beit Shammai is listed before Beit Hillel, which shows you, by the way, that the Mishnah is from Beit Hillel. Meaning the Mishnah is, meaning Rebbe is 100 years, you know, is about the year 200. Beit Hillel was 150 years before that. But if Beit Hillel is teaching, or if the generation after Beit Hillel is teaching Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai Omrim, Beit Hillel Omrim, you see already that it's the heirs of Beit Hillel that are teaching these Mishnayot. And now, Rabbi Tarfon comes and says, Ani hayiti babaderech, I was traveling, v'hiteti likrot, and I lied down in order to read Shema, kidivrei Beit Shammai, in accordance with Beit Shammai, v'sikadi ba'atzmi v'pnei alistim, and I endangered myself, I put myself in danger of robbers, of highwaymen. Amrulo, and they said to him, who's the they, doesn't say, but the generation of Rabbi Tarfon is Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. They said to him, Kedai hayita lachuv ba'atzmecha. Well, if something would have happened, you would have deserved it. Shavarta al divrei Beit Hillel, because you violated the words of Beit Hillel. Okay? So at this point already, following Shammai is considered, it's something bad, meaning it's not something, you don't even want to take it on as a chumrah. Since when do we not take things on as a chumrah? Okay, there's a machloket between this one and this one, I'll be machmir.
This is a life indeed. You wouldn't put yourself at risk.
You wouldn't put yourself at risk in order to be, you wouldn't be machmir. You wouldn't, you're mekel on sachanas nefashos in order to be machmir on that.
But also, Abtafan said in another machloket at that time that if you had two opinions, one was machmir, one was mekel, it was incumbent that the one that was machmir to prove the point, not the one that's mekel, which is the opposite of what we do today.
Well, I don't know if it's opposite what he do today, but it's opposite what Rabbi Tarfon did. Rabbi Tarfon himself. Yeah. It's an interesting point. Rabbi Tarfon, why was Rabbi Tarfon doing this? Is it because he wanted to be Yotze all the Shitos? Is it because he thought on some level Beit Shammai was right? Is it because he was a student of Shammai? Right, so that's part of the thing about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. All right, let's get back to the more theoretical.
But where do we introduce this? Or Machmir or Mekel?
Why do we think that Beit Shammai is more Machmir and Beit Hillel is more Mekel? We'll get to that in the next couple of minutes. It says it in a Mishnah, okay? By implication. Fine. So you have all these factions and sects from the Second Temple period. One became Rabbinic Judaism, or Judaism. That is the Pharisees, the Prushim. Rabbinic Judaism was descended from the Prushim. There is one theory by Shai Cohn that says that there was some sort of, you know, kumbaya moment at Yavne after Churban Bayit Sheni, but it's a das yachid. It doesn't really hold water. For the most part, the rest of them died out. One became Christianity, the non-Jewish religion of Christianity. The rest sort of disappeared. And then the Purushim became rabbinic Judaism, which became the only form of Judaism until Karaism arose in like the 8th century or the 9th century.
I don't even know who the Purushim
were. The Pharisees. Right. The Pharisees were, they're the people that, they're whoever the rabbis were before the rabbis. Purushim means separatists. Nobody calls themselves separatists. The other guy's always the separatist. Splitter! Right? Splitter! You know that scene, right? Monty Python, Life of Brian, right? Like, we're the Judean people's front, and we're the popular front of Judea. It's like, you know, oh, whatever happened to the popular front of Judea? It's like, oh, he's sitting over there. Splitter! Right? Split. Purushim means splitters, right? That's what it means. Right? So it's not us, right? So the Purushim, they were some, they were less temple-centered. They had a different, halacha.
But they became, Judaism?
They became rabbinic Judaism. They became the Tanaim, and that became the dominant.
Who's the earliest person considered a Pharisee?
I don't know. Shimon ben Shetach, maybe. Shimon ben Shetach, right. Shimon ben Shetach, when does the Purushim end and the Rabbanim, the Tanaim, begin? Around Chorban Bayit, maybe at Yavneh, maybe with Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are, let's say, around the year 50. And we'll see that inside, but I don't want to give it away. Around the year 50, you have Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Okay? How long did they last? How long were these academies? What? They're towards the end. They're the transition from the Pharisees to the rabbis. Okay. So now you have this group called the Pharisees. Josephus says that the masses are with the Pharisees. He doesn't say that the masses are Pharisees. He says that the masses, most Jews, sympathize with the Pharisees. Okay? The Purushim. The good guys.
Okay?
Not really. They just... Well, the Pharisees, they were.
The
Tzedukim were in power more. It depended when. Again, it depended when. Okay. But within the Purushim, you have two schools. You have Beit Hillel and you have Beit Shammai. And Beit Hillel won. But Beit Shammai is still on the page. Beit Shammai is still part of the corpus. Unlike any of those others, we don't say about them, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. We only say about Beit Shammai, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. So why? Why weren't Beit Shammai treated the same way that you treated all these other groups? There are... Yes, mutual respect is a big part of it. So to answer the question, we need to know what their similarities were, and we also need to know how they're different. In terms of, there's always a question even today, when does partisanship turn into schism, right? When, today the question is, who's Orthodox? Then the question is, who's really a Pharisee? Is Beit Shammai part of the Pharisee movement? Is he not part of the Pharisee movement? If you think about today the question of who's considered Orthodox, oh wait, if you have a mechitza or don't have a mechitza, I think that's the point. They do things that are different from what, you know, this group does something different from that group. So in what sense are they part of the same group?
The methodology is the same tools that they're applying.
Maybe, maybe not. Meaning there's similarities between the Pharisees and the Sadducees too. Everybody agrees which day Shabbos is. So what is the difference? So there's a lot of theories. There's one theory, Gratz, the historian in the 19th century, has a theory that the difference was basically political. Beit Shammai was more hawkish. They wanted to rebel against Rome. Beit Hillel was more dovish. Some say that it was more of a question of class, that Beit Hillel was more patrician. Beit Shammai was more of an underclass. Let's take a look at the Mishnah in Yevamot. Let's start with Maaser Sheni. Kerem Ravai. Okay, what's Karam Ravai? Karam Ravai is when you plant a vineyard, in the first 3 years, you're not allowed to eat any of it. That's Arla. The fourth year, you can eat it, but you have to bring it to Yerushalayim. If Yerushalayim is too far, you can redeem it and bring it and bring the money to Jerusalem and eat it there. And buy food there and eat it. So Beit Shammai says, Ein lo chomesh, meaning normally when you redeem it, and then you have to redeem it not for equal value, but you have to add 25% of the value. Even though it says chomesh, it means 25, one-fifth after the fact. Ve'ein lo biur, and there's no time limit. Right? Once you do this, you don't have to, there's no time limit. Whenever you get to it, you get to it. Beit Hillel says, Yeshlo. It has a chomesh, you have to add that 25%, and it has a shad biur. You have to bring it to Jerusalem to redeem it and buy food with it within a certain amount of time. 3 years. Beit Shammai omrim, Yeshlo peret, v'yeshlo olalot. Beit Shammai says that it has peret, meaning you have to leave part of it for the aniyim. Peret and olalot, these leftovers. The smaller clusters you leave for the poor, and what do the poor do with it? And the poor people, they also have to be podeh. Meaning, you're not going to go to Jerusalem with one tiny little thing of grapes, but you can redeem it, and then that money, even if it's a quarter, even if it's a dollar, you have to spend that in Jerusalem. Beit Hillel says, no, kulo lagat. You can harvest it all. You don't have to leave peret and olalot. So, from Beit Shammai's perspective, Beit Shammai, it might seem that, I'll say it straight out, Beit Shammai, whether or not this is intentional or not, Beit Shammai provides a way for people who aren't large landowners, and even for people who are poor, to participate in mitzvot like Maaser, like Karam Ravai. Right? If I have one vineyard, Karam Ravai comes, whatever I make this year from this vineyard, it's not that much. Beit Shammai is saying, there's no time limit. Redeem it, you have $100, you don't have to schlep all the way to Jerusalem to spend that $100, keep it around. In another couple of years, you'll have another vineyard, you'll add another $100, you'll get to $1,000 eventually, and you'll take that and you'll spend it in Jerusalem. You're poor, you don't have any land whatsoever, you can go onto the land of someone else, collect their peret and olalot, redeem it, and then you, poor, unlanded person, will be able to participate in the mitzvah of Karam Ravai. You will be able to go to Jerusalem and spend your money there. So on one hand, you can read that politically. Beit Shammai wants to reinforce the center, Jerusalem, the capital. Or you can read it as through a lens of class, through a lens of economics, that you want to give. It's great that you have the mitzvah of Karam Ravai and the mitzvah of Bikurim and all these agricultural mitzvot that you can participate in if you have land. Or if you have enough land. And Beit Shammai is saying, no, even if you don't have any land, even if you're on the dole, that you're going and you're collecting the droppings from somebody else's field, you still have an opportunity to participate in these mitzvot. This next mishnah is one of my favorite mitzvot.
So it sounds like Beit Shammai is more noble. Meaning like he's taking the poor people into consideration. He's saying everyone.
On one hand, yes. On the other hand, no. On one hand, he's making it like it's. Beit Hillel is like, yeah, if you don't have that, if you don't have any land, you don't have. You're putter from the mitzvah. You don't have to do it. You don't have to do ololo. You don't have to do peret. You don't have to do.
And Beit Shammai, you don't have to do it. It's if you do it, you can do it. Meaning it sounds like it's a. A fair kind of thing.
Put it this way. I think Beit Shammai comes out here
looking better,
and also it's not really, you don't really talk about Kula and Chumra here. This next one.
There's just, maybe, I don't know if this is something that seems to be getting into it now, but with Beit Shammai, there's sort of this presumption that you have your little jar, buried under the mattress, and you know, money that's eventually going to go to Yerushalayim.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe the Hillel doesn't think that's the best idea. You're sort of opening yourself up to violation here. Yeah.
Maybe.
The poor guy is going to run low on money, and this jar of money is staring him in the face for 3 years.
Maybe.
And he's going to be tempted to spend it.
Maybe. Maybe. So it could be that that's... Beit Shammai, the next mission, Mishnah in Yevamot. Beit Shammai, if you want to talk about a Mishnah where Beit Shammai comes out smelling like roses, this is talking about something called miyun. Miyun is if a young girl under the age of 12, if her father had died, her brother and her mother may marry her off. And she, because it's not her father, she has a right to refuse that marriage, even after the marriage took place. So Beit Shammai says, "Inu ma'anin ela arusot," that mi'un can only be done by a woman who's been betrothed, by a girl who's been betrothed, but once it's been consummated, there can be no mi'un. Beit Hillel says, arusot and nesuot, even after it's been consummated. Beit Shammai omrim beba'al below beyavam. Beit Hillel omrim beba'al uviyavam. Beit Shammai omrim, meaning that afterwards, you know, like two brothers or a brother, like Beit Shammai omrim b'fana, Beit Hillel omrim b'fana v'shalo b'fana, Beit Shammai omrim b'Beit Din, Beit Hillel omrim b'Beit Din v'shalo b'Beit Din. It doesn't have to be in front of a Beit Din. The miyun doesn't have to take place in front of the husband that she's rejecting. Amru lehem Beit Hillel bo Beit Shammai. Beit Hillel says to Beit Shammai, "M'ma'enet v'hi ketana afilu arba'a v'chamisha pa'amim." She can do this. She can do miyun even 4 or 5 times. Her mother and her brother can marry her off to a guy. The marriage can be consummated. And then she could be like, you know what? I don't want to be married to him anymore. Goodbye. Next. 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 Beit Shammai freaks out. Look at what Beit Shammai says. Does he give a halachic argument? No. He says, "Ein benut Yisrael hefker." You're legalizing prostitution. What is wrong with you, Hillel? No, mima enet v'tamantanadachitagdilvatimaedvatidasei. She can only happen once, right? You can marry her off once. It can't be consummated. You wait until she gets older. Then she can either consummate the marriage or she can refuse the marriage and marry who she wants. 4 or 5 times? You can marry a girl between the age of 6 and 12 off to 5 different guys and she just one after the other just says, never mind, I'm a mima enet. And then she's on to the next guy. That's... Beit Shammai is outraged.
He's operating under Beit Hillel's command right now.
He's saying that Beit Hillel legalizes this. Beit Hillel is makil. Beit Hillel is matir all of this. And Beit Shammai is like, this is insane.
I don't know Shammai's response. I don't understand. According to his opinion, you can't do it after the...
Correct! Ein benot Yisrael hefker! You can't turn a 6-year-old Jewish girl into a child prostitute! That it can only happen once. That if she does mi'un, she has to wait until she's 12, and then, meaning either way, she has to wait until she's an adult before consummating the marriage. Because she's not actually married until she's an adult, which is age 12. Okay? We'll keep going until we get a minion. Yeah, I'm going to... Yoni? Moving on. The Mishnah in Machshirin is a good example of another... Okay, do we have a minyan? Yes, minyan? Yeah, we do. Okay. So we'll finish this up next week. We got to cut down on the questions. We really do, because it ends up... Two things. We got to cut down on the questions, and I'd like to be able to start on time, if that's reasonable.